that flagrant violation of international law that was destroying a civilization. It began in June 2007. And for 3 years, there wasn't a peep from the international community, not a word of dissent. And then suddenly, after the martyrdom of the 9 passengers in the Mavi Marmara, suddenly all the world's leaders awakened. And singly and in unison, they all start to use the same word. The Israeli siege of Gaza is unsustainable. The blockade has to be lifted. For 3 years, not a word. And now they suddenly discovered the blockade of Gaza was unsustainable and had to be lifted. The prison gates of Gaza have been pried open only a few inches. But those inches, they show the latent power of a movement built on the simple truth that the occupation is inhuman and unjust. If the people in the Mavi Marmara showed what we can and should do, and the people in Washington, Tel Aviv, and regrettably also Ramallah show us what we shouldn't do. Our resources are scarce, our time is scarce. We shouldn't waste our time, we shouldn't squander our energy on this meaningless sideshow, this contemptible, meaningless sideshow called the peace process. There never was a peace process, there isn't a peace process, and for the foreseeable future, there won't be one. That's not just rhetoric. That's what a rational person concludes looking at the record. A rational person, he or she judges not by words, but by outcomes. So, we have sitting in the third row a man. What's your name, sir?
Gordon.
Gordon. Don't worry, the cameras are pointed in my direction. You're safe. So, Gordon has a grandson. We'll call him Johnny. And little Johnny, he's 5 years old. He goes over to Grandpa Gordon. For those of you who are Arab speakers, we'll call him Baba. And he goes over to Baba, Grandpa Gordon, and he says, "I'm going to be a doctor when I grow up." Gordon surges with pride. That chip off the old block, my grandson, Johnny, he's going to be a doctor. Then Johnny, he starts grade school. Not terrific. Doesn't perform brilliantly in class. In fact, he's not going to class. The principal calls down Johnny to his office, calls in Baba, tells Baba that Johnny is not performing up to par. Johnny turns to Grandpa and says, "Grandpa, I'm going to be a doctor." Okay. Johnny goes to middle school. Johnny goes to high school. Johnny is cutting his classes. Johnny's a truant. Johnny's hanging out with the wrong kind of people. Johnny is robbing banks. Johnny is mugging old people. Johnny kills a couple in their bed at night. Johnny is hauled before the judge. Johnny is sentenced to life. Baba, and I can see from his face, he's very disappointed. Baba goes to see Johnny in jail, and Johnny says with his stupid grin, "I'm going to be a doctor." At this point, Grandpa gives him a smack and says, "You're probably not even my son, grandson." Now, some of you are wondering, what does that have to do with the peace process? And maybe Finkelstein, since he talked with or surged with pride about the 1960s, maybe he took a few too many mind-altering drugs of his own. But in fact, it has everything to do with the peace process. Because just like Johnny, we have now 17 years to look at the record. And let's see what happened. The so-called peace process is said to have begun in September 1993. The Oslo Accord, the famous handshake in the White House lawn. And for the past 17 years, there has been this thing we hear about every day, the peace process, the peace process. I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be a doctor. The peace process, the peace process. Well, let's look at the result. Let's look at the outcome. In September 1993, there were 250,000 illegal Jewish settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories. 17 years later, there are 500,000. The number has doubled. According to the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the occupied territories, Israel has now annexed 42% of the West Bank for the settlements. So judging by outcomes, and not by words, judging by outcomes, there has not been a peace process, there has been an annexation process. The peace process is the facade behind which the annexation process unfolds. In fact, the annexation process needs the peace process. Because whenever Israel is held to account, for example, for the illegal Jewish settlements, what does it say? It says, the question of the settlements, it has to be negotiated in the peace process. And as the peace process unfolds interminably, behind it, the annexation process continues uninterrupted. But some of you say, but wait, maybe that was true in the past, but things have changed. Because there was a settlement freeze in the last phase of the peace process. And aren't we now debating whether or not the settlement freeze will be extended? But here's a question. How can you extend what never existed in the first place? There never was a settlement freeze. Sounds like rhetoric, fair enough, until you look at the facts. The main Israeli organization responsible for monitoring the settlement growth is the Israeli organization Peace Now, and they put out monthly reports. They looked at that 10-month period where all of you, or we all, were hearing about Mr. Netanyahu's settlement freeze. They looked at that 10-month period, and here's what they concluded. On the ground, there is almost no freeze or even a visible slowdown. Settlement freeze, it was a fiction right from the outset. It was a fiction right from the outset. Does that mean we were all tricked, fooled? It was all a scam? Actually, it was quite clever what happened. Because if you looked at the terms of the agreement, it was a freeze on new construction. A freeze on new construction. So what happened? 6 months before Mr. Netanyahu announced the settlement freeze, 6 months before, he met with the settler leaders and he said, all you have to do is lay the foundations for new homes. Then I'll announce the settlement freeze and you can continue to build the homes, because it's not new construction. It's construction that began before the settlement freeze was announced. And so the number of homes that went up was just about the same number as before the freeze was announced. Does that mean that Mr. Netanyahu gets no credit? No. We have to be fair. He has significant achievements to his name. And Peace Now described one. Referring to the settlement freeze, Peace Now said, Mr. Netanyahu will probably not win the Nobel Peace Prize, but he is certainly likely to win the Nobel Prize for physics, or at least chemistry. Why? Because he has discovered that, contrary to what scientists had thought until now, water is not the only substance that expands instead of contracting when it freezes. The whole debate about whether or not Israel should be obliged to stop building settlements during the peace process itself was detached from reality. There is no dispute whatsoever in international law, there is none, that the settlements are illegal. All 15 judges in the International Court of Justice, including the American judge, reached the opinion in July 2004 that all the settlements are illegal. Under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, the settlements constitute a war crime. So it's a curious peace process that would debate whether Israel should be allowed to continue committing war crimes during negotiations. Does a convicted thief get to continue stealing until the judge hands down a sentence? If it's pointless to squander energy on the peace process, it's equally pointless to squander energy trying to figure out what Mr. Obama wants. Our job is to muster sufficient political will so that Mr. Obama does the right thing, or at any rate doesn't keep doing the wrong thing, regardless of what he wants. When you focus on the powers on high, when you're waiting for a Messiah, even a black Messiah, it's a confession of impotence. There's a simple but fundamental truth of politics, which even the most resolute of atheists could agree to, and that is, God helps those who help themselves. God helps those who help themselves. If you don't like what's going on, if you think it's unjust, if you think it's wrong, you have to look to yourself, or we have to look to ourselves, to make the right thing happen. And you look for people on high to make it happen. In my opinion, at any rate, you're squandering energy and you're squandering time. Now, I've been involved in this thing for some 30 years, and it's a very sobering thought. It really is, that my entire adult life has passed on this conflict. And I've devoted so much time and energy focused on one tiny pinprick on the world's map. Forget about what Israel and Palestine look like from the Milky Way. And There's lots of reasons to feel hopeless and despairing and to even sometimes wonder whether it was the most prudent of investments of a lifetime. But actually now, amid all the grim news and all the grounds for despair and worry, there actually is excellent reasons to be hopeful and optimistic. There are. Public opinion is changing. If you look at the polls for Canada, public opinion is changing. Jewish public opinion is changing. Most Jews are liberal. 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama, which is a much, much higher percentage than Latinos who voted for Barack Obama. Latinos was about 63%. When you factor in income, Jews being by far and away the wealthiest ethnic group in the United States, they should be voting Republican. But no, Jews vote the Democrat. They're liberal. And liberal basically means, in the American context, support for the rule of law, equality before the law, support for human rights, support for international organizations. It's liberal organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and Richard Goldstone who are in the forefront criticizing Israel. And so for Jews, it's become much more difficult to reconcile their liberal credo and beliefs with what Israel is doing. A young man interviewed me just before I came to speak here, and he asked me about the tense climate on college campuses. And I said to him, well, actually, it's not true anymore. It's very rare any longer that you have the kind of hysteria, the heckling, the demonstrations, and all the rest. Why? Because most young Jews are liberal, they're idealistic, and they do not want to have to publicly defend what's plainly indefensible. If you're a Rush Limbaugh, a Sean Hannity, you know, some throwback to Precambrian men, then it's okay, it's not so difficult. But if you're young, Jewish, liberal, idealistic, you don't want to defend dropping white phosphorus on hospitals. You don't want to defend an assault on a humanitarian vessel carrying cargo to Gaza. And so there's a lot of reason for hope now. Public opinion has changed. But it's not enough for public opinion to have changed. It has to be turned into a political force. Because if it's just you two saying to each other, I don't like what Israel is doing, or it's you, listening individually to the news or watching the news and shaking your head, I don't go for that, what Israel's doing. It doesn't have any political consequences. People have to be organized and turn their disenchantment or disgust into a political force. We have to organize. But if we organize, I think there's now sufficient public opinion that if it's organized, it can make a difference. And our challenge now, in my opinion, is twofold. Number one, we have to be principled. We have to be principled, and that means we have no right to tell the Palestinians that they have to forfeit any of their rights in the interests of a settlement of the conflict. Those are their rights, and we have an obligation to either support their rights. I did not say support anything they do. I said support their rights, or, if you'll excuse my Brooklyn English, or then just shut up. But don't tell Palestinians that they have to forfeit any of their internationally guaranteed rights in the interests of reaching a settlement. But on the other hand, we have to be reasonable. We have to show Israel, its supporters in the US, that there is a way to resolve the conflict. It does not have to go on through eternity, and it does not have to have, which it may very well have, catastrophic consequences. Just be reasonable. Respect the decency, the humanity, and the right to a good life of everybody living in that area. Be reasonable. Those elementary moral principles, do unto others what you would want done unto you. Be reasonable, be just, be fair. The Palestinians are not asking for the sun, the moon, and the stars. They want the same right as everyone to have a fair chance at life's happiness, a fair chance. Everyone in this room is old enough to know that human beings have a remarkable capacity for messing up their own efforts to have a good life. But everybody has a right to a fair chance at life's happiness. If you mess it up, that's your problem. But nobody should be deprived of the right to achieve it. And that's what the Palestinians are asking for. The same basic rights as everyone else. If you're reasonable, if you're fair, if you're just, if you're decent, elementary human decency. And as the late Professor Edward Said, at the end of his life, he liked to quote the Caribbean poet M.A. Césaire. And the line he liked to quote was, "There's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory." There's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. This is not about victor and vanquished. I don't like that terminology. I don't want to be victorious because that means somebody else has to be vanquished. And I don't want to vanquish anyone. I want just for everyone to come out of this with a decent prospect for a good life. If you're on board for that, then there's room for you at that rendezvous of victory. Now, I'm getting on in years, and sometimes I'm hopeless, and sometimes I'm despairing, but I still hope, maybe against hope, but I still hope that I'm going to be there at that rendezvous of victory, but I'll only get there if all of you are there with me. Thank you.